Support for That Trippy Show comes from Odoo. What is Odoo? Well, Odoo is the only software your business will ever need. Featuring a suite of integrated business applications, Odoo connects your business operations together so you get more done in less time. Odoo has apps for everything: CRM, accounting, sales, HR, inventory, marketing, manufacturing, you name it. Odoo's got it. To learn more, visit odoo.com/trippy. That's odoo.com/trippy. Hey everybody, it's Joe Trippy and welcome back to That Trippy Show. This week we've got a ton more questions about Moore versus Harper and wanted to dive deeper into it, so we brought in an expert. About this time last year, we had Rick Hassan, author and law professor at UCLA, on. We talked about his book, Cheap Speech and Election Integrity. Since then, we've quoted him a ton. His essay, Trump is Plotting a Much More Respectable Coup Next Time, is still scarily accurate, maybe even more so now after the last few weeks and months. We thought we'd have Rick back on, talk about what it means and what's next. Rick, welcome back.
It's great to be back with you.
Alex, what do you have for us? Where do you want to get started?
Well, you know, we mentioned in pre-show, Rick, we've been quoting you a while, and the one we keep quoting is, and I just want to remind our listeners what you said, and this was almost 2 years, I think this was from August 2021, so this is 2 years ago. The potential coup next time will come in neatly filed legal briefs and arguments, quoting Thomas Jefferson, and wrapped in ancient precedents and purported constitutional textualism. It will be no less pernicious. And Rick, I thought that was a great place to start, just given, you know, your recent piece in Slate, which we'll link to in the show notes. But I'll tell you right now, if you're listening to this expecting us to cheerlead this decision and say everything is right with the world, you may want to change the channel.
Well, I mean, the first thing I'd say is that the worst case scenario was avoided in this case. It is a partial victory that the crazy was rejected. The kind of theory that John Eastman and Clayton Mitchell and these other Trump lawyers were putting out, that state legislatures have this kind of free-floating power to throw out votes from voters who voted for president and just pick their own electors, that's gone. So that's good news. And I don't want to overcorrect and say, oh, Moore versus Harper is no big deal. It's a huge deal. It's probably the biggest bullet dodge in U.S. election history. But it's not all good news. And I think that's what you're referring to.
Well, it's not over, right? So where do you give us the other side of it then?
So, you know, I've talked about election cases for 2.5 decades, and this is probably the most complicated one. So give me 2 minutes to just kind of set the stage so people understand what's going on here. So the Constitution says that state legislatures get to set the rules for conducting congressional elections, subject to Congress's override. And also state legislatures get to set the manner for choosing presidential electors and presidential elections. One part's in Article 1, Section 4 of the Constitution, the other part's in Article 2. The crazy theory, the one that the court rejected, was that this gives legislatures some power that they can act irrespective of what state courts might say, the state constitution says about the limits of their power, that they have this kind of free-floating power. That's gone. But the Supreme Court, in a 6-3 decision, with the liberals signing on to the majority opinion, said that the U.S. Supreme Court and federal courts get the last word on the meaning of state law in state election cases. That's not really such good news. So let me give a very specific example so we can understand this. You may remember the disputed 2000 election, Bush versus Gore. At the end of that, it was very close between Bush and Gore in Florida. Whoever won Florida was going to win the presidency. And the Florida Supreme Court ordered a partial recount of some of the ballots in Florida. And the U.S. Supreme Court stopped it. The majority opinion, written primarily, we now know, by Justice Kennedy, said it's an equal protection violation because you're not treating voters the same. But there was a separate opinion from Chief Justice Rehnquist, joined by Justices Scalia and Thomas. And this is the seed of what the court did in Moore versus Harper in its recent opinion. Chief Justice Rehnquist said the problem with what the Florida Supreme Court did in ordering this recount was that they didn't really follow the usual rules of interpretation, and they stretched Florida law too thin. And therefore, when they did that, they violated the Constitution, because the Constitution says state legislatures get to set those rules for conducting presidential elections. And what the court said in Moore versus Harper, citing to Rehnquist in Bush versus Gore, the very first time in 23 years that a Supreme Court majority opinion has cited Bush versus Gore for anything, the court said that when a state court transgresses the ordinary rules of judicial interpretation, they're violating the U.S. Constitution. What that means is that if there's another disputed election, like in Florida 2000, it's going to be up to the U.S. Supreme Court to decide whether the state court has gone too far in interpreting its own law, and therefore it could be trumped by what the U.S. Supreme Court thinks. That was a pretty steep price that the liberal justices paid to get an opinion that rejected the crazy.
So you say price paid. So I'm assuming, and I'm curious what you'd ask your students about this, about, so when this decision came down and how it came to be, was there, do you think, some of that kind of horse trading about how it was going to be worded? And the conservatives that ended up voting with the liberals on this said, okay, we'll vote on it, but we want this opinion to say this, because the dissent is pretty wild as well.
Well, so, you know, the dissent, two of the three justices in the dissent, Thomas and Gorsuch, would have adopted the most extreme version of this theory. We don't know exactly what went on behind the scenes, but you can imagine the three liberal justices, Kagan, Jackson, Sotomayor, saying, you know what, we don't agree with even the weaker version of this theory. We're going to dissent. Then you'd have six justices dissenting, but on different theories. It would be a mess. So they wouldn't necessarily have to have engaged in horse trading. They might not have even said anything explicitly. But if Roberts puts out his opinion and says, look, here's an opinion that's going to very strongly reject the crazy, but it's also going to embrace a role, continue role for the Supreme Court, and resuscitate Justice Rehnquist's opinion. Remember, Justice Rehnquist is who Chief Justice Roberts clerked for. There's a pretty clear line there. Remember, Justice Kavanaugh worked on Bush versus Gore on the Bush side. You know, the price to pay to get a majority opinion rejecting the crazy, I think, was signing on to this thing that's giving the court a license to second-guess state court decisions and give people who don't like state court decisions a second bite at the apple. And where, let's be clear, where is this most likely to happen? When a Democratic-elected or Democratic-appointed state Supreme Court interprets its election laws to provide more protections for voters, and Republicans complained and said the state court has gone too far.
Right. I think there's a quote that you said that it's easy to miss that the Supreme Court has now set itself up with the assent of the liberal justices to meddle in future elections, perhaps to even decide the outcome of future presidential elections.
They set themselves up. So now let me take a 2020 example, but bring it closer to home. You may remember we were voting in the middle of the pandemic, and there were a lot of lawsuits about how the election was going to be conducted, given that it was hard to vote in person and the mails weren't working very well. Some voting rights people went to the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, and they said, because of all the problems with voting, we think that the number of days by which absentee ballots have to be received to be counted should be extended by 3 days. So instead of the ballots having to be received as it was under state law by election day, they could be received up to 3 days later. And the Pennsylvania Supreme Court said, yeah, that makes sense. The state Supreme Court applied the state constitution, which protects voters' rights, and said, to protect voters' rights in the state constitution, we're going to extend by 3 days. And so Trump's allies went to the U.S. Supreme Court and said, doing that, extending by 3 days, violates the U.S. Constitution, because now the state Supreme Court has usurped the power of the state legislature to set the deadline. What this case says, Moore versus Harper, is that this is now a live issue. The Supreme Court's going to have to decide, did the Pennsylvania Supreme Court deviate too much from Pennsylvania's own precedents about voting in the past when it decided this issue. And even worse, and Justice Thomas raises this in his dissent, the court doesn't exactly say what the standard is going to be to judge when a state Supreme Court has gone too far. That means there's going to be lots of room for motivated reasoning, lots of room for judges to be able to say, you know, like, I don't really trust the liberals on the state Supreme Court. I think they've deviated too far. I'm going to turn it back.
So is that why you call this a milder version of the independent state legislative theory? I mean, is that the point you're trying to make there?
That's right. So the court rejected the crazy version of the theory, which the legislatures have free-floating power to do whatever they want. But the milder version is state courts can't deviate too much from what the legislature wants without violating the U.S. Constitution. And what that too much means, good luck figuring that out.
So you mentioned first, I like how you started this with Bush v. Gore. This has been a long time coming. And the case that set this up was a long time coming. And one of the reasons that I think your piece gets to that maybe we shouldn't be having a full-fledged celebration is this is just one of the latest, we'd call it on the pro-democracy side, call it an assault on democracy, but there are a ton of legal machinations happening in almost every state, really. And we'll talk on a future podcast about this too, but this is not an isolated incident. There will be more. I think it gets to one of your points. I mean, my question is more, this has been a long time coming, right?
Oh, yes. I mean, this is part of the long-term legal strategy. And you opened up by quoting my piece in Slate from a couple of years ago about the white-shoed coup next time. It's these kind of rarefied legal theories. You know, Trump gets up there and flails his arms and yells about voter fraud, and there's no evidence to support it. And the courts say, you know, go away. But when you make a kind of nuanced, sophisticated legal theory that could potentially coincide with theories of originalism and textualism that are, you know, associated with judges and justices on the right, then you're going to get a hearing at the court. Doesn't mean you're necessarily going to win, but you're going to get a hearing. And now you've got, for the first time, a majority opinion of the Supreme Court saying federal courts are open for business to hear these kinds of claims.
Right. So you get a second bite at the apple, basically, is what you're saying. There's a second, the U.S. Supreme Court gets to second guess every state ruling that it wants to wade in on.
A second bite of the apple by potentially more favorable judges. So right. Again, if you're talking about a Democratic state Supreme Court in Pennsylvania or now Wisconsin, and the state legislature doesn't like it, they'll go find a sympathetic federal judge, or they'll go all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court and try to raise these issues.
That Trippy Show will always be free with support from our advertisers, and we try to work with partners we believe in. This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. When you keep what's stressing you bottled up, it can really start to drag you down. That's where therapy can help. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists anytime. Make your brain your friend with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/trippy today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/trippy.
So, and this gets to a reader question I'm really excited to ask. So on the surface, you look at it, 6-3 vote. This is from Shelley, who's actually in North Carolina, so thanks for asking this, was how close did we come here? I'm paraphrasing a little bit, but for a case to get to the Supreme Court, in theory, it should in theory have merits one side or the other, right? Like if it doesn't have standing or if it's too out there, they would have never agreed to hear it. So how close was this, do you think, Rick?
Well, so it is too close for comfort, but, you know, how close do we come to embracing the crazy? I was very glad to see that Justice Barrett, who's one of the newer justices, right? She was the last Trump justice approved just before he left office. She sided with the majority here. She was not willing to go to the extreme. Even Justice Alito, who signed on to the part of Justice Thomas's opinion that said this case is moot because there's been a change at the North Carolina Supreme Court, so this issue is no longer live. Even Alito didn't sign on to the crazy. So, you know, in retrospect, it doesn't look like a close case. But we had, you know, I think it was almost a half a dozen cases in 2020 where this theory was raised in emergency motions before the Supreme Court. This now at least gives us some clarity. So the Supreme Court had to take this case. And I think the reason they decided it, even though it was probably moot, I think I agree with Justice Thomas, the case was probably moot. They decided because they knew they had to say something before the 2024 elections when this would start all over again.
But do you have any insight into why you think they took this task? I mean, it just seems, is it because they wanted to signal something, or that they were afraid of doing more damage to the court? I mean, is there some reason they took this, or is it just they took this middle ground in a way that let them sort of keep the door open for the 2024 election to still, I guess the way it's, hey, everybody, big sigh of relief. They didn't do the more extreme thing, but they can still do the more extreme thing if they decide to do it. Is this some sort of half measure to protect the court and still be able to, you know, rule, you know, second guess a state court in the field? I mean, is it to keep that open? And that's why some of the justices went along with this. I'm just sort of getting to whether there's a deeper game going on here. I don't like to use the word game with the court, but I think that's where we are now. What's your perspective, Rick?
I would say, like, this is really inside baseball. It takes only 4 out of 9 justices to agree to hear a case. You don't need a majority. And we know that Gorsuch, Alito, and Thomas have been saying, got to hear these cases. And Kavanaugh had been saying it too. There's your 4. Now, once the case is before the court, I think Roberts has been trying to take a middle path. And, you know, given how the goalposts have moved, even preserving the status quo looks like a win. Same thing with the voting rights decision out of Alabama earlier in the month, mm-hmm. where what the Supreme Court said was, we're going to apply their laws, the Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, as it's been understood since 1986. This was seen as a huge victory. And it was a victory, but it's a victory that kept things in place. What didn't happen is the court didn't say the Voting Rights Act is unconstitutional. The court didn't say the Voting Rights Act has no meaning. Those were both live options. So when you've got extremes on the table, then doing something that is not great, but a lot better than the extreme looks like a progressive victory.
And same thing with Louisiana. I know we were talking about this before, but it to your point, we're over here celebrating like it's like it was supposed to go in one way or the other. But in 3 cases now, and I know the court just didn't hear this last one, they've basically let things stand the way they are without really doing anything seismic.
Yeah, I think that's right. And this court not doing something seismic, a court that decided Dobbs and got rid of the right to abortion, that's a big deal when the court kind of keeps things as they are.
So, Joe, we've taken kind of a big arrow out of the quiver, because I know this was something that the Trump campaign was counting on next year. Obviously, we'll see a lot of other tricks and other legal maneuvering. Do you think this changes the map at all anywhere in some of these battleground states, like even North Carolina now, Georgia, Arizona, or do you think those same states we were fighting in 2020 will stay the battlegrounds in 2024?
Oh, no, we're fighting in the same places. I think that the difference, at least on the Alabama decision, there may be, remember the court, you know, essentially in all their rulings, or most of them in that election, held off on letting anybody change lines, you know, kept what was clearly Alabama in particular, you know, there was a seat we would have, the Democrats, the pro-democracy side, whatever you want to call it, would have won in 2022. And that wasn't the only place. There were rulings like this, where they basically kicked the ball, you know, kicked the can down till after that election before they took this position. And so I think that could change things, particularly in the House. There may be 4 or 5 seats now where it's going to be, you know, the gerrymandering that was allowed to continue for that cycle will be fairer for lack of a better way of putting it. But I think in the terms of this decision, I think Rick's right, though. I mean, the question is, so, you know, it's a 15,000 votes in Pennsylvania, and there's a county, you know, the state legislature, the county is accused of not counting things right. The state legislature decides to seat some other, you know, again, and then it goes to the Supreme Court. They've said we get to adjudicate that, and that court may be the Supreme Court, maybe a far different one than in terms of how it looks at the law and what it's doing than the one in Pennsylvania. It's just one example, but you can't, you know, it's there still can be many nightmare scenarios despite winning the popular vote. And, you know, and again, going back to Florida in 2000, it could be a completely different, even harsher situation in terms of the Supreme Court making it, particularly with this composition of the court.
Support for That Trippy Show comes from Odoo. What is Odoo? Well, Odoo is the only software your business will ever need. Featuring a suite of integrated business applications, Odoo connects your business operations together so you get more done in less time. Odoo has apps for everything: CRM, accounting, sales, HR, inventory, marketing, manufacturing, you name it. Odoo's got it. To learn more, visit odoo.com/trippy. That's odoo.com/trippy.
So, Rick, I want to ask you kind of the same question, but we've got 50 states, all with somewhat different to vastly different voting laws. You mentioned Pennsylvania and how they added 3 days on to count. There are some states still that are struggling about whether you can count absentees before election day or wait till after and how they report. I mean, what implications does I guess these last couple decisions have, and where do you see the next fight?
So I think Joe's right. It's going to be the close states. That's where the stuff's going to matter. And what I think this ruling does more than anything else is that it puts state courts on notice that their opinions are open to second guessing. And that's going to lead to some creative drafting of those opinions to try to insulate them from these kinds of claims, to show that the ruling is consistent with the state's history. It's going to be kind of a legal parlor game. And ultimately what it comes down to is the Supreme Court has said, we get the last word. Now, not surprising, the Supreme Court says we get the last word, but if you're a lawyer and you follow this stuff, you know that when it comes to what state laws mean, generally, it's not the U.S. Supreme Court that gets the last word. Each state Supreme Court gets the last word. But no, when it comes to elections, the Supreme Court says, well, we're keeping a finger in here. And that just becomes now part of the political strategy that the campaigns are going to be paying attention to. You know, is there some ruling, some determination that can be challenged under this theory? And, you know, if there is, we know that litigants are going to take it because there's no holding back now. The amount of election litigation in the period since Bush versus Gore compared to before Bush versus Gore it's tripled. And thanks to a change in law about a decade ago, the political parties can do separate fundraising for legal defense funds. So there's every incentive to litigate the hell out of these cases in close elections.
Right. And we're seeing there, I mean, even right now, Trump is fundraising for his own legal defense fund. So, you know, I wanted to get to actually an analysis that Mike Podhortzer put out actually over the winter. It was before this thing was decided that he made some really interesting points. And one of the broader ones was that he calls it this revanchist coalition. And his point was the far right basically believes that the 20th century was wrongly decided. So going back and hitting all these major cases over the 20th century that they believe were wrongly decided. But there are some fault lines in kind of where the far right is between the capitalist the kind of pro-business agenda, and then kind of this new ultra-MAGA wing. I'm curious if you see that having any effect, really, for future cases.
Well, just looking at the court, which is where I have my focus, there certainly are fissures. And it's a mistake for people on the left to look at the right as though it's monolithic. That Voting Rights Act case from early in June, Allen versus Milligan, the strategy was to divide the conservatives and to find a theory that would work for them. I think there are different factions. There are some justices on the court that are more extreme than others, and some more open to persuasion than others. And I think this is true politically as well. There are certain arguments that people are willing to accept, and others that they're not. Look, let's take a really crazy example. Justice Alito, you know, he took that trip on the private jet and tried to claim that an airplane was a facility so that he wouldn't have to report it. It was like the most ridiculous kind of interpretation of the rules you can imagine. And so I attacked his analysis for, you know, not following his own textualist rules that he's supposed to apply. No conservatives have really come to Alito's defense on the merits. They've said, oh, you're singling out, you know, the conservative justices, or look at this bad argument that was made against a different justice. So the point I'm trying to make is that there are some limits to what people are willing to argue, and there are some nuances of opinion among conservatives. And so that has to be something that's taken into account when you're trying to litigate these cases, when you're trying to make both political and legal arguments. There's no monolithic approach to these questions.
Well, then on the flip side, you got, I think it was Justice Jackson who reported that she got flowers from Oprah. So there's a bit of a disconnect there. I do want to read this a bit of a longer quote, so bear with me here, from Mike, that I think kind of puts a bow on where we're going with this. And this gets to the kind of whole dog catches the car thing. But he says, these many offenses against democracy were made possible by a Federalist Society majority on the Supreme Court, which dismantled the Voting Rights Act, which you just mentioned, Rick, opened the floodgates to billionaires' campaign spending, and greenlighted the egregious partisan gerrymandering that enabled Republican line drawers to keep all but one of the 90 of their number who voted against certifying the results from running in a remotely competitive district. The one who did have to run in a competitive district was Steve Chabot, and he lost in Ohio. And he concludes by saying, we must stop normalizing these decisions by treating each election as if it were free and fair as the ones before those decisions, quote unquote, democracy advocates, do MAGA's work for them when they grandfather these injustices. And this is why I wanted to read this, because he quotes Monty Python. He explains the problem brilliantly here, saying every time the Federalist Society justices hack off another limb of democracy, we keep insisting 'tis but a scratch and move on. So long-term, Rick, is there any long-term solution, maybe not on one side or the other, but just kind of end some of this anti-democratic chaos?
Well, so let me do something I don't normally do, which is express a note of optimism. The fact that the court did not embrace the crazy in Moore versus Harper and kept the Voting Rights Act in place, I think this shows there are limits. And I think this is, you can't understand what the Supreme Court has done in the democracy space in the last month without understanding how the standing of the Supreme Court has been falling, and how the constant attacks on the court, justifiable attacks on the court, they're making a difference. I think the court is responding to public opinion. They're responding to elite opinion that sees the court is going too far. One of the other pieces of good news in Moore versus Harper is that the Supreme Court reaffirmed a 2015 ruling that said that voters in Arizona could take the power to redistrict away from the legislature and give it to a redistricting commission. That's good news. And so I think that there's been a little bit, and Roberts, who is the one who wrote the opinion in Moore versus Harper, dissented in that Arizona case, and here he is lifting it up. You know, why is that happening? I think it's a pulling back from the precipice. So I think at least for someone like Roberts, who cares about the legitimacy of the court and who's not at the court's extreme anymore, there are limits. So it's not every case chopping off another limb. And so I'm going to say that let's keep the pressure on And let's, you know, hold the justices to account when they take anti-democratic moves. But it's not always that the sky is falling.
And so is there, I mean, for our listeners, is there something, I mean, would you urge everybody to be vigilant, to, like you just said, to call them out if there's more anti-democratic? I mean, is the people's voices here making a difference, you think? And should we be, you know, rallying to that when they get it wrong? Or is that one of the most, what's the most productive thing that the average American can do right now?
Oh, I do think it's vigilance, but it's not just vigilance about the court. So let me talk about something we haven't talked about. Like, what about state legislatures? This opinion says they can't do the most extreme thing, but they can still do something pretty bad. So here's one of the nightmare scenarios I'm worried about. State legislature in North Carolina or Wisconsin, over a governor's veto, passes a law that says, we are going to be the canvassing board. We are going to be the judge of who's won the presidential election in the state. We're not taking the power ourselves to vote for the electors, but we're going to decide who's won the election. I think under Bush versus Gore, and nothing contrary in the Moore versus Harper case, that's perfectly constitutional. That would be horrible. But we've got to be vigilant about moves like that, because I think that is still allowed, because unfortunately, the Constitution does not protect our right to vote. It only says if you're going to hold a vote, you can't discriminate on the basis of race or gender. It does not protect a right to vote. Maybe I'll come back on your show in February, if you'll have me, and I'll talk about my, I have a book coming out called A Real Right to Vote, explaining why we're not going to get out of this box until we have a movement towards a constitutional amendment that actually guarantees a right to vote and a modern democracy. Otherwise, we have to worry about courts. We have to worry about election administrators. We have to worry about legislatures. We've got to be vigilant all the time, because there are people who are trying to make it harder for people to vote and to register to vote.
Well, Rick, you're a friend of this show and democracy, and we will for sure have you on anytime you want. And we'll look forward to being, you know, having you back in, hopefully before February, but definitely in February as well, when your book comes out.
Oh, that's great. Thank you.
Well, Joe, that's just about all the time we've got.
Okay. Thanks, Alex. Thanks, Rick, for coming on. And thanks, everyone, for listening to That Trippy Show. We'll link to Rick's latest piece in our show notes. Rick, is there any place else on Twitter or anywhere that people can find you that you wanted to let the audience follow you?
Well, since Elon Musk, I've been on a semi-Twitter strike, you can find everything that I write over at the Election Law Blog, which is electionlawblog.org.
Okay, we'll put a link to that in our show notes as well. A reminder that this podcast will always be free as part of the ResoluteSquare.com network. Check out the latest at ResoluteSquare.com/Trippy. Please subscribe to That Trippy Show and leave a review on Apple or wherever you listen. You can always send us a question to thattrippyshow@gmail.com. I think Alex actually got to one today in the show with Rick. And you can leave us a question always in a review on iTunes. See you all next week. Thanks again, Rick.
Thank you.